Tonight we're thinking about how Christian leaders lead. See, we have an expression which we use sometimes. The expression is this: there are horses for courses. There are horses for courses. And this expression can apply to lots of things in life, but it certainly applies to leadership. For example, no one would deny the abilities of Alistair Cook, the England Test cricket captain. Go back, that's it, yeah. Alistair Cook, okay? So he is the English Test cricket captain. He is an accomplished cricketer, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but when the English cricket board went to appoint someone who would be the one-day international captain, they didn't choose Alistair Cook. Instead, they chose an Irishman, Owen Morgan. Because both of these guys have cricketing abilities and skills and leadership abilities. But there are horses for courses. Alistair Cook's ability to lead the English cricket team is much, much better exemplified when he leads the test team. But Owen Morgan's when he leads the one-day international team, the 50-over side team. So that's kind of interesting that there are horses for courses. There's some kinds of cricket that one person stars in and their leadership is cut out for, other kinds of cricket where it's not so and you need someone else. And it's not just the English who do this. The Australian test captain is Michael Clarke. Well, it's not at the minute because he's injured, but he's hoping to be back shortly for the one-day international series. But that's the Australian cricket captain, but he doesn't captain the T20 squad. The Australian T20 squad is captained by Aaron Finch. He's a big lad. Looks like he should play rugby rather than cricket. But anyway, he captains the T20 squad, which probably makes a lot of sense because he is the holder of the international record for a T20 innings. He scored 156 runs off 63 balls. It's an incredible score, okay? And he was involved in today's 50-over victory of Australia over India. He's an incredible cricketer. He's their T20 captain, not Michael Clarke, because there are horses for courses. And when it comes to leading in the church, there are horses for courses. In a church this size, there are many people who have leadership gifts, and those gifts will be recognized in all sorts of arenas. For example, your leadership gifts may be recognized in the place where you work. It may be recognized in some pursuits that you're involved in your leisure time. Or it might be just whenever anybody sees you in company, because if you're standing in a room, there'll always be other people around you because you just happen to have that kind of personality and people look up to you. And so even you don't have a formal position of leadership, you'll end up leading wherever you are. And that's reality in life. There are formal leaders in structures and there are informal leaders, and you have to come to terms with this. When I went to Bloomfield as an assistant minister, my boss gave me the responsibility of looking after the youth work. And the uniformed organizations pretty much looked after themselves. So my key responsibilities were the youth fellowship and the youth club. And of course, first thing I had to do when I got there was get to know the leaders of the youth fellowship and the youth club that the Kirk session had appointed. And there were about 10 of them. But the first night I turned up at the youth club, I realized there was another set of leaders I would also have to get involved with. And that was the set of leaders that existed amongst the young people in the room, because when you went into the hall and you looked around, you could see them gathered in groups. And in the center of each of those groups was some one individual who was significant. And I knew that if I was going to be able to lead this work and move it somewhere, I had to come to terms with and I had to win the respect of the formal leaders appointed by the Kirk session, but I also needed to win the respect of the informal leaders that were all around me amongst the young people. One of them was a student lawyer. One of them was a young woman who was a trainee teacher. One of them was a diesel fitter. But every one of them were leaders amongst their peers. Because there are horses for courses. And the problem is, you might naturally think that anyone who has a gift of leadership, whether you have noticed that leadership in some church organization or in that person's life outside the church, you might think, well, they're a leader, they could be an elder. Well, it ain't necessarily so. There are horses for courses. You don't appoint Alistair Cook to be the captain of the one-day international side because Owen Morgan will do it better. And there may well be loads of people in this church with leadership gifts, but that doesn't necessarily mean that every one of those who has leadership gifts would be suited to be an elder, because there are horses for courses. We're trying to go somewhere as a church. We set ourselves themes each year, and we try to explore those themes and to move into them as God leads us and walks with us. And our theme for this year, as I've said, is Disciple, the Way of Jesus. And therefore, it's really important that if we're just about to appoint leadership in the life of our church, the people who are going to lead need to encourage us along that way rather than holding us back or taking us in a different direction altogether. And that's one of the problems about leadership, particularly in a denomination that organizes itself like the Presbyterian Church. Because what tends to happen is that, for example, with ministers, one minister leaves, another minister comes. The minister who comes has got a totally different approach to ministry and has different set of ideas and priorities to the person that preceded them. And whilst you've been going in one direction with one set of leadership, then all of a sudden you take a 90-degree turn and go in a completely different direction. You don't keep on pressing into what it is God is saying. Why? Because we didn't choose the right leader. So as we begin to narrow down the field over these next few weeks in the life of our congregation to try to identify the people we think God is calling into leadership amongst us, how would those leaders lead if they were going to lead rightly? Well, what I want you to do tonight is to think about the direction we're trying to go in. We've been exploring church and our Christian life by placing a grid over the top of it and asking the same question about each of the areas of our lives, either as a church or as Christian individuals. For those lives to be disciple-making lives, for those activities or organizations to be disciple-making activities and organizations, they need to be moving simultaneously in three directions: up, in, out. They need to be under the lordship of Christ, they need to be building community together, and they need to be going to a world that is lost. And if the activities or organizations that we run or the style of our own life doesn't fit in that grid, we're not disciple makers. Whatever else we might be, we are not disciple makers unless those three directions are at work in our lives or in our organization or in the life of our church. So, if we applied that grid to the leadership, what would that tell us about how we should lead? Let's place this grid over the question of leaders, okay? Up, in, out. What would that look like if we applied it to leadership? How would Christian leaders lead? Christian leaders lead, first of all, with their heart. They lead with their heart. Peter, who wrote the letter from which we read a moment or two ago, Peter had a lot of faults. We explored some of those last year in our series about being sent. Some of those faults were personal things. They had to do with his personality and his character. Some of those faults had to do with his prejudices and his bigotry as a result of his upbringing. And Peter recognized that that was so. Whenever God sends him to the home of Cornelius, who was a Roman centurion, a Gentile, a place that Peter would not normally have gone, he says this in Acts chapter 10, when he gets to Cornelius' home and he's having a conversation with him, he says to him, "You are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile. But," he says, "God has shown me that I should not call anyone impure or unclean." Wow. What a change. I'm in your home because God told me that I'm not to count anyone impure or unclean. What changed his mind? See, for all Peter's faults, and there were lots of them, for all Peter's faults, there was something else that was true about him, which was that he really loved Jesus. That was why he was so offended on the seashore on the morning, one of those mornings after Jesus was raised from the dead, and they caught some fish, and Jesus cooked them over a fire. And then he says to Peter, "Peter, do you love me?" But he didn't just ask him at once. He asked him at three times, and Peter was hurt. He said, "Master," he said, "you know I love you." Because Peter's heart was good, you know. He really loved Jesus. And it was that love for Jesus that made a difference in his life. So when he writes to these young believers in that letter we read a moment or two ago who lived in Pontus and Galatia and Cappadocia and Asia and Bithynia, that's what we nowadays call Turkey, okay, that's where they lived. When he writes to these believers, he says that they were, quote, chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and sprinkled with his blood. See, what excites Peter about these people in Turkey is that they were opening their lives up to God the Father, to God the Spirit, and to God the Son. They were, like Peter, obedient to Jesus Christ. And that's what excites Peter about them. He sees in them something that was true of himself, because he goes on to say in chapter 1, verse 8, about these same believers, he says, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you love him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. Peter sees in these Christians in Turkey what was true of himself. He loved Jesus, and it was his love for Jesus that set him free to go to the home of Cornelius with the gospel. He knew when he did it that he would be in trouble. He knew that because there is no place on earth where you will experience judgment quite like being among religious people. It's sad, but it's true. The most judgmental place on the face of the planet is often in the Christian church. Sometimes people don't even need to speak for you to feel their disapproval. You walk into the room and you know from the expression on their faces they don't approve of you. And Peter knew that when he went to the home of Cornelius that some of these religious people would have a problem with him. And that's exactly what happened. Acts chapter 11, verse 2, it says, the circumcised believers criticized him. But it didn't make any difference. Peter loved Jesus. And Jesus sent him to Cornelius' home. So Peter went. The clue to his life was his love for Jesus. And though Jesus warned him that this lifestyle of loving him and obeying him would mean all sorts of problems for him, it would mean prison, it would mean suffering, it would even mean death, Jesus told him about this, he still went because he loved the Jesus who sent him. So he says to the leaders in this Christian church in Turkey, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. To lead, he says, not because you must, but because you are willing as God wants you to be. The only reason to lead the people of God is because you love Jesus who sends you to do the job. Church leaders lead with their hearts. They are devoted to Jesus Christ. And you can see it. There's something about them that makes that clear. You see that in different ways. I told one story this morning. I'll tell a different one tonight. You see it in different ways. After when Sharon Lynn finished her term here as worship leader in this church, I had the dilemma of trying to figure out where were we going to go next. Sharon gave me plenty of warning and notice about it. And it was over that period of time that I felt God really was saying to me, we needed to get Kaz to come. One of the reasons why I felt that was because anytime I had been in a place where she had led in worship, I noticed something about her. I noticed that you could never watch Kaz leading in worship and not realize that something was going on in her heart. And I think I've told the story before. I think I told it when we were saying goodbye to her here, when she went off to the States, that the night she came to be interviewed and she sat down to play in what's now the staff room in the back corridor there at the piano, and she played My Jesus, I Love Thee, I Know Thou Art Mine. It for me, it was the end of the interview. Because what she did was she sat down at a piano and she played music. But it wasn't music I heard. what I heard was the passion of her heart for Jesus. It just flowed through her fingers and through the piano keys and through the music. Reduced me to tears within about 30 seconds. There was no point in going on with the interview. I knew what we needed to do. And then she left, and I had to replace her. Where were we going to go next? There's only one Kaz. Well, there's only one Dave. And so we went there next. How did I know we were supposed to go there next? What was it that made me think, yeah, this is what God wants us to do? Because a number of years before this, this same son of mine had very loudly said in our house, I will never work for the church. And then he started to work for Alpha. And then he started to get involved in music here in church. And in a different way from Kaz, what I could see in him was a love for Jesus, because the only thing that can make somebody who says, I'm not going to work for the church ever, work for the church, is love for Jesus. Nothing else does that. And so you can see this in different ways in people's lives, okay? Sometimes it's more on the surface of those lives, like maybe it was with Kaz, and when she sits down to lead you in worship, you kind of know that something's going on between her and Jesus that's special. And sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's much more rational, or if you like, than that, where somebody makes a decision which for them is a really costly decision, and you know that the only reason they could have taken that decision was because they love Jesus. Christian leaders lead with their hearts. Quite frankly, if this is missing, nothing else matters. Nothing else matters. Because if you don't love Jesus, you'll never do this job right. But if you love Jesus, that's a good place to start. Peter was a leader because he loved Jesus, and Jesus sent him to do it. And whatever Jesus sent Peter to do, that was what he did. Christian leaders lead with their hearts. An elder is first and foremost a worshiper. Don't even think about voting for somebody you don't see in worship. Unless a desire to worship and love and exalt and glorify, spend time in the presence of Jesus, is there in a person's life to be seen by all, don't vote for that person. They can't be an elder, because you lead with your heart. But Christian leaders also lead with their hands. New Testament leaders are always hands-on people. You can see that for yourself. Just take a look at the New Testament. Take Peter, for example, whose writings we're thinking about tonight. Peter says to these Turkish leaders in the local Christian church, in verse 3 that we read earlier, he says this: how should they lead? Not lording it over those entrusted to you, but, he says, being examples to the flock. Being examples to the flock, okay? These are hands-on people. Now, we spoke last week about how Jesus' way was often to get other people involved along with him. That's the way he works. And he was always doing this. But the reality was that Jesus also knew that sometimes there were things that he had to do himself. While most of the time he was drawing other people in, using their resources, using their gifts, encouraging them to work, and he would stand alongside them to help them, there were some times Jesus knew that as a leader, he had to get his own hands dirty. So, on the night before he goes to the cross, he's in the upper room with his disciples celebrating the Passover together. And he gets up from the table and he strips to the waist. And he ties a towel around himself and he picks up a basin and a bowl of water. And he goes around the room and he washes his disciples' feet. And then when he's done it, he says this. Now, he says, now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. This is one of those one another verses that I talked about a couple of Sundays ago in church. Those verses by which the New Testament indicates the significance and importance of Christian community. And Jesus draws his disciples into Christian community by getting hands-on. in leadership terms. It's a hands-on moment when Jesus sets a disciple. You see what I just did? I need you to do that for each other if you're going to build Christian community together. Let me ask you this. Where is that person you're thinking of voting for in the session election? Where is that person when something needs to be done? Are they ready volunteers, people who are always there building community, getting involved with other people? Is that who they are, or can you not see them for dust? New Testament leadership is hands-on leadership. It is leadership by example. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean physical activity, okay? It doesn't necessarily mean stacking chairs and doing stuff like that. It can mean that, but it means more than that. This is Andy Stanley. And we had a debate about this at the lunch table today, and the consensus is that I haven't got the right person for this story, but who cares? I thought I heard Andy Stanley tell this story at a conference. The consensus is it wasn't him. But anyway, I'm going to tell it like as if it was him, all right? So what I thought I heard Andy Stanley say was that Andy Stanley is a pastor of a large American church, mega church, grown to thousands of worshippers and so on a Sunday. But like most of these mega churches, it was planted small. And they started, I think, in a school or something like that. So they would have to come in early on a Sunday morning, bring in a whole pile of people and a whole pile of kit to set the school up for worship. And then at the end of the day, they'd have to clean the floors and leave the school the way it was for the pupils coming in the next day. And so early on in their life, one Sunday morning after worship, Andy Stanley was there. Worship was over. They were getting cleared up. And he was brushing the floor at the front of the hall. And one of the other members of the team, the setup team, came to him and said, "Andy, give me that brush. I'll do that." And Andy said, I thought I heard Andy say that actually he felt himself, "I don't want to appear here, you know, that I'm above brushing floors." So he said, no, "I'm very happy to brush the floor. That's okay. Let me get on." "No," he said, "Andy, give me the brush." And Andy said, no, "I'm going to do this." "Andy," he said, "there are people standing out there in the foyer. Heaven knows that we need new people to join the church. Would you go and talk to them and do your job so I can get on with doing my job?" And if it was Andy Stanley, he said that was the moment at which he realized that leadership is hands-on, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's me being hands-on at stuff that someone else should do, but it will mean me doing something hands-on. And in his case, he needed to go and talk to the new people standing in the vestibule to encourage them to come back and not taking up space on the setup team who were quite capable of getting on with the rest. So being hands-on doesn't necessarily mean physical activity, stacking chairs or making tea and coffee or doing things like that. We should never be above that. But it means using the gifts and abilities that God has given us in leadership to build community. It can be brushing floors, but it can be other things as well. The point is, are these people you're about to vote for doing any of that? Are they? And it's not just being active and setting an example. It's the way you are active and set an example. Peter says in verse 2, "Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, watching over them." He uses the idea of shepherding as a picture, a metaphor of what hands-on Christian community building looks like. Being a shepherd. Now, we have a sentimental view of the idea of shepherds, and it's largely based on stained glass windows of Jesus Christ with a lamb either on his shoulders or in his arms. And what we have here is that this, of course, is Jesus with the parable of the good shepherd who has 100 sheep, and one of the sheep is missing, so he leaves the 99, and he goes out to search for the one, and when he finds the one, he puts it on his shoulders, and he carries it home to the flock. And that's our view of being a shepherd. And it's largely governed by stained glass windows like this. And the problem with it is that view of being a shepherd also informs our idea of what it means to pastorally care for people. Now, elders are pastoral carers, so therefore this is important. Our view of pastorally caring for people is like visiting ones and twos in their homes. But think about this for a minute. Where did the good shepherd who left the flock to go and find the sheep that was lost and brought that sheep back to the flock, where did that good shepherd spend most of his time? With the one or with the 99? The good shepherd spent most of his time with the flock, caring for them, feeding them, making sure they were safe at nighttime, dealing with the issues that they had, shearing them when the springtime came, and all the rest of it. The good shepherd spent most of his time not with the one who was lost. Of course, he left the flock to go to look for the one that was lost, but most of his time was spent looking after the 100 when they were all together. One commentator points out that the picture of the shepherd means that the Christian leader is a concerned guide. He's a guide. And the place of a guide is among a group of people who need to be taken somewhere. His place is among the many. A good elder will love a pastorate or some form of corporate church life where they can be a group in a group of people serving others and building community. That's what Christian pastoring really means. Of course, it includes seeing individuals in situations of need. But that's not fundamentally what it's about. Fundamentally, it's about caring for people in community. I have a friend called Philip Emerson. He leads Emmanuel Church in Lurgan. Philip has never visited my home, but he has often been my pastor. How come? Well, for one thing, he calls a group of his friends together that I get invited to. We used to travel to Lurgan, now we go to different places. And in that group, Philip gathers all these people together. Some of them are quite senior in Anglicanism and our denomination and other churches and so on. And they all gather around him. Phil has this kind of style and way with him. You come into his place and you get a cup of tea and coffee, and then he starts to talk about something that he's just noticed in God's Word this morning, which just amazingly seems to be relevant to virtually every life in the room. And you feel cared for, and you feel at home, and you feel pastored. I remember another occasion, we were at the Alpha Leadership Conference together in England, and we had to walk through Hyde Park in the morning to get from our hotel to where the conference is. And I specifically remember one morning walking with Phil and Dave and a couple of other people, and he had a word for each of us that he had somehow dug out of some obscure passage in Ezekiel in the middle of the Old Testament about 3 days before this. And I think this is a word for you guys, he said, as we walked through Hyde Park. And it was powerful. He's never been to my home, but he's been a pastor in my life. You know what? I think Christian leadership is much more about having people to your home than about being in the homes of others. It's much more about hospitality and openness and living your life with and around and before others so that in your life they see who God is and they yearn to be like that and they get pastored as you do that. So is this person you're about to vote for a hands-on guide in a pastorate right now or in a youth organization? Or as a helper on a grief share course, or whatever. Are they in any way demonstrating the fact that they can build community and gather people together, that they can in their lives lead in the direction of inwards? Because if they can't do that, they can't be an elder. Because you've got to lead with your hands. Got to set an example. Got to show people what community looks like and build that community all around you. We lead with our hearts, we lead with our hands, and we lead with our feet. Peter was an elder himself. And it gives a certain force to his writing. You know, it's one thing for somebody who's never been an elder trying to tell elders what they should be doing. Nobody likes that, you know. It's just being a smart aleck, and nobody ever responds to that. But Peter is an elder. He knows what it feels like to lead in a local fellowship. And he tells them that right at the beginning of the letter. But of course, it wasn't all he was. Because again, right at the start of the letter, as custom dictates, he identifies himself. And we write letters nowadays. Well, who writes letters? But if you were writing a letter nowadays, you sign your name at the end. But in Peter's day, you signed your name at the start. You began with who you were. And so Peter does. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1, he says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. It's a really interesting way to start. Why? Because Peter wasn't his name. He wasn't called Peter. He's called Simon. Simon was his name. But everybody called him Peter. As I said in church this morning, you know, it's a bit like Rodney. Everybody knows Rodney Rogers, but Rodney isn't his name. It's the name of the street that he grew up in. And everybody calls him Rodney, but that's not actually his name. And I was doing a funeral a couple of weeks ago, and there was a guy there who I know by a certain name. I discovered in the funeral that that's not his name. I don't know how he came to get the name, but even his mother calls him that name. How does that happen? I don't know. Peter wasn't his name. Peter was the name Jesus gave to him as a way of redefining his life, redirecting his life, saying, Peter, Peter was anything but a rock. But Jesus saw this in him. He prophetically called it out of him. He said, your name from here on in is Peter. He introduces the letter with a name that wasn't his, but it was a name that indicated who Jesus had called him to be. And then he says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. You know what apostle means? It's a Greek word, it's both a verb and a noun. It means to be a sent one. To be a sent one. To be what Jesus renamed him to be. Peter had to use his feet. There was going to be no other way to do it because he was going to be an apostle. That means Jesus was going to send him. He had to get up and go. To go to do what? Well, in 1 Peter 5, verse 1, we read a moment or two ago, this is what he says. To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder and a witness of Christ's sufferings. Peter was sent with a story to tell. He was a witness. And this is a rare combination, okay? This is a rare combination in someone's life. That on the one hand, they build community in the church, and on the other hand, they go as a witness to the world. It's a rare combination, but it's a telltale sign of apostleship. Peter had it. Paul had it. Romans chapter 1, verse 1. Paul was a messenger. He had a story to tell. He was a witness. He says, Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, and set apart for the gospel of God. He was a gospel man. He was a man with a story to tell. He was a witness. And later on in the same chapter, just to underline how important this was to him, he says in verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel. I'm going to tell it to anybody who's going to be willing to listen. But this same Paul, who was a gospel kind of guy, who was out there in the world telling the story, the same Paul, when speaking of the trials involved in leadership in 2 Corinthians 11, says this, besides everything else that I have to do, he said, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Paul loved the church, but he was also a witness to the world. You can see all three directions in his life. Paul was a worshiper. Later when you go home, take out Romans, the letter to the Romans, read chapters 9 to 11. There are three chapters in which Paul discusses the vexed question of what is going to happen to his own people, the Jews. And he breaks his heart over them and rejoices in the purposes of God because he believes that God is not finished with them. He has a purpose still to fulfill. And he argues really closely through those three chapters about what God's plans are and what God is going to do. And then he can't help himself. At the end of chapter 11, he breaks into worship. He just stops. He just stops the argument and he worships God. How amazing he is, he said. How incredible are his thoughts. Before from him and through him and to him are all things forevermore. Amen. Paul has the up direction in his life. He loves the Lord. But Paul also has the in direction in his life because he visits churches and he writes letters to them and he's constantly in the company of people. He never goes anywhere on his own. He always takes two or three other young believers with him. He is always building community, always moving inwards. And Paul has the out direction in his life because he spends himself for the sake of all the rest. Paul believed that if Jesus loved him and went to the cross to die for him, it wasn't for the sake of Paul. Paul believed that Jesus did that for the sake of all the rest. And it was for the sake of all the rest that Paul had feet with which to serve the Savior. You can't lead this church unless you face outwards. Unless there is the upward direction in your life, surrendered to the love of Christ. Unless there is the inward direction to your life, building community and drawing other people in. But you definitely can't do it unless there is the outward direction to your life that lets you live for the sake of all the rest. Does this person you're about to vote for have feet? Would you find them leading an alpha small group? Or have you ever seen them bring a non-Christian friend to worship in church or to some event or activity that the church is running? Have you ever seen them do that? Because if you've seen them do that, then maybe, just maybe, they might be the kind of person should lead us. Sandy Miller tells the story when he went to, when he took over in HTB as vicar. He had been assistant to John Collins, who was his boss. And when John Collins retired, Sandy Miller was appointed in his place as the vicar of HTB. HTB was a small London church at that stage, not particularly influential, not particularly alive. And Sandy tells the story of how he was desperately hoping in his heart that the Lord would turn this church around and give it a ministry that would make it influential in the city of London. And he's sitting at the front of church one Sunday morning. He's not long the vicar. He's up at the front dressed in all the paraphernalia and regalia of Anglicanism, okay? And he's sitting in his seat somewhere up at the front near to where the communion table is. And the service has just started and he sees a young man in his early 20s coming through the back door and sit down. And he's overjoyed, because that's exactly who he wants to see coming into church and sitting down. He wants to reach a new generation for Jesus. The young man stays in church for about 10 minutes, and then he gets up and walks out again. And Sandy said that he's sitting here, and if it wasn't for the fact that he had so many clothes on him, he would have got up from the front of church and run after the young man down the aisle, out into the street, and pleaded with him to come back in again. But he couldn't do it. What he did do is this. He said before the Lord that day, sitting in all this regalia at the front of the church, I made a decision. The decision I made was that that would be the last young man to enter this church who would get up and leave before the service was over, because we were going to change this church with God's strength in such a way that loads of young men like that would come into this church and stay and find Christ and have their lives transformed. And this church would build and grow to the glory of God. HTB now operates on a Sunday morning over four campuses. Tens of thousands of people worship in those four campuses every weekend. And it started that Sunday morning when Sandy Miller took a decision in his heart that we would do whatever it was we needed to do to get that young man to stay. Why did he do that? Because he was a Christian leader who had feet. He believed that he was where he was for the sake of all the rest. And it was his job to do whatever he needed to do to reach all the rest. We need people with hearts and hands and feet. Let's pause for a minute as the band comes. Let's just be quiet in our hearts. See, I'm aware every time I talk about leadership in church, and every time I say what I believe the New Testament to say about leadership, I think on my own life and my own experience, and I think about how far short I fall from the standard I've just preached. And I'm sure if you're an elder or a significant leader in the life of the congregation, maybe that's how you feel right now too. And maybe this is an opportunity to do two things in this election process and life of our congregation. The first thing is this. Maybe this is an opportunity for people who are currently leaders in the life of our church to refocus. So easy in the midst of leading in church to just get caught up with church, doing church well, and forget about the fact that we have a master who is more important than the church, and whose opinions matter more than anybody else's opinion in the church, and who will one day call us to account for what we do. And we need to make sure that we're doing what he called us to do. And we can only do that with our heart, our hands, and our feet.